Welcome back to the Deep Dive. This is the place where we take the sources you share and really cut straight to the crucial context. We want to make sure you walk away not just with information, but with, genuine insights.
Today, we are opening up a topic that is, well, it's foundational to millions of people, the narrative surrounding the Golden Plates. And really, the incredible transition of Joseph Smith from a local, kind of controversial treasure seeker to a foundational religious prophet.
And our mission here, as always, is one of informed consent. We're going to provide a thorough, evidence-based analysis by taking the source material you provided us.
Specifically, we're looking at the gritty contemporary 1820s accounts,
Yeah.
and we're going to stack them directly against the more sanitized, the officially correlated 1838 narrative.
That really is the core tension we're exploring, isn't it? The official version, the one most often shared, it tends to remove the complex, often messy flavor of 19th century New York folklore.
Right. And when you look at these competing histories side by side, a central theme just jumps out. Joseph Smith's absolute need to control the narrative, to control the physical environment and the audience around these mysterious plates. It was all about ensuring his status as a seer remained viable.
Precisely. So if we begin by looking at the timeline provided in the sources, everything, and I mean everything, it begins and is born out of treasure digging.
That context is just telled. It's absolutely crucial. The practice of using a seer stone or glass looking for the purpose of seeking filthy lucre, that is treasure, it sets the expectation for how a local seer was supposed to operate in that specific time and place.
And before we even jump into the plates themselves, we have to note a historical problem with the timeline of his spiritual claims. The correlated history places the first vision, where Joseph is allegedly told all existing churches are wrong and corrupt, in 1820. But the sources we have indicate that if he experienced a revival-driven spiritual event, it historically aligns much better with the intense religious enthusiasm happening around, what, 1824.
That chronological discrepancy creates a significant historical problem. I mean, think about it. If the first vision really happened in 1820, there's this strange 3-year gap where Joseph Smith, having been told by God himself that all denominations were an abomination, he still spends his time vigorously pursuing earthly enchanted treasure.
Doesn't quite add up.
Not really. But if that vision happened later, say 1824, then the entire plate's narrative is just the natural logical progression of his existing professional treasure-seeking career. It's a career shift, not a divine interruption.
Okay, let's hold that idea of a career progression. I think that's a good frame as we unpack the context of section one. Let's start right where the sources tell us everything began, the culture of treasure digging. Our sources reiterate that Joseph Smith was documented as being willing to use, well, deception during his treasure digs. This wasn't a purely spiritual calling, it was a business.
And success in that business relied entirely on maintaining control over the dig site and, the expectations of his clientele. If he lost control or failed to produce, he lost his credibility as a seer. It was that simple.
So this reliance on deception, or at least highly managed expectations, is basically the core DNA of the entire plates narrative that comes later.
It is. As the source material highlights, the entire enterprise begins with this folk magic practice, the ability to control who sees what, when they see it, and what they believe they saw. That becomes paramount to his entire later religious success.
Okay, so let's go to the first alleged visitation and retrieval attempt in 1823. We should probably start with the official 1838 account, right? That's the version most people know today.
Right. In that version, Joseph Smith claims he removed the earth, used a lever, and saw the plates, the Urim and Thummim, and the breastplate all lying in a cement box.
And the key detail, the one that gives him 4 years to prepare the narrative, is that he was forbidden to take them until September 1827.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is how that 1838 account is so carefully scrubbed clean. It removes any reference to the supernatural folklore or folk magic that might make it sound, disreputable to a wider 19th century American audience trying to establish a new, legitimate religion.
But even the sanitized version leaves behind these strange material details that, well, they defy both history and archaeology.
Like the missing box problem.
Yes, the missing box problem. That's a major red flag in the evidence.
A huge one. The claim is that the plates were resting in a structure formed by laying stones together in some kind of cement on Hill Cumorah. This wasn't just a hole in the ground, it was a physical structure.
And for 2 centuries since, people have looked for it.
People have scoured that specific hill, Mormons, ex-Mormons, curious individuals with shovels, even metal detectors, and yet no remnants of this substantial concrete structure, no foundation stones, no cement fragments have ever been located.
Wait, let's just pause on that for a second. If the golden plates were removed by the power of God or an angel, why would they also remove the concrete box and all the surrounding structural evidence?
That is the question, isn't it?
If this was a divinely placed material artifact that was supposed to last for thousands of years, it should have left archaeological evidence, at least an empty pit, much like the foundation of any long-gone stone structure.
And when you're forced to say, well, with God, all things are possible, to explain away the lack of physical evidence, you are disconnecting your story from reality. Logically, that makes it indistinguishable from an intentional fabrication.
Okay, so now let's connect that physical paradox to the contemporary 1820s accounts, which are just steeped in this folk magic lens.
Yes, accounts like Oliver Cowdery's letters to W.W. Phelps. They paint a very different and, frankly, a very human picture of that 1823 attempt.
How so? What's different?
Well, Cowdery mentions that when Joseph tried to grab the plates, he was immediately overpowered by an invisible power that deprived him of his strength. And Cowdery explicitly links this to Joseph's existing worldview. He says Joseph had heard of the power of enchantment and a thousand-like stories which held the hidden treasures of the earth.
So that frames the plates, in their minds at the time, not as a divine record from an angel, but as enchanted, guarded treasure.
Exactly. It's subject to folklore rules.
Yeah.
The implication there is one of continuity. If the initial attempt is framed by the participants themselves as a failed attempt to overcome an enchantment, a spirit guardian typical of treasure lore, then the only difference between this failed dig and any other failed dig is the supposed nature of the treasure itself. It's an enchanted object, not a sacred one.
And crucially, Cowdery describes the power of three motif. Joseph made three attempts.
Yes. The first two produced a shock. The third attempt failed entirely, leading Joseph to cry out, "Why can I not obtain this book?"
And this power of three thing, that's not random.
Oh, not at all. The sequence of three attempts, three failures, three witnesses, three visits from an angel. This is a fundamental and pervasive trope in 19th century treasure digging and folk magic. The idea is that a ritual must be repeated a specific, usually odd number of times to break an enchantment.
So he was operating entirely within that ritualistic worldview.
Completely.
Oh.
Which reinforces the idea that this was, to them, a standard, if highly dramatic, failed treasure dig.
So to sum up the first attempt, the 1838 version gives us a linear divine narrative that leaves behind the paradox of the missing cement box.
Right.
And the contemporary 1823 account gives us a standard failed treasure dig where the guardian spirit overpowered the seer due to enchantment, leaving behind no material paradox, only failure.
And that contrast brings us perfectly to the transition point.
All right.
The 1826 trial.
The trial for glass looking.
Exactly, for scrying. While the records are fragmentary and the church long denied the trial even happened until records were found, the trial itself serves as a crucial strategic pivot point.
I need more detail on that. Why was glass looking illegal? What were the charges?
Well, in 19th century New York, many laws, often filed under things like vagrants and disorderly persons, were used to prosecute people who made money through what was deemed fraudulent divination or fortune telling.
So he wasn't just a hobbyist. He was being paid.
Right. He was hired by prominent local figures like Josiah Stoll to find treasure. When he consistently failed to produce that treasure, yet continued to take fees, it led to legal trouble. The trial forced a public reckoning with his professional practice.
So the trial was about fraud, not theology.
Absolutely. It was about obtaining filthy lucre under false pretenses. And this is where Joseph Smith Sr. steps in with a crucial reflective quote, delivered just before the family needed to make a strategic shift.
What did he say?
J.S. Sr. expressed mortification that his son's wonderful power, which God had miraculously given him, should be used only in the search of filthy lucre. He said he trusted that the Sun of Righteousness would someday illuminate the heart of the boy and enable him to see his will concerning him.
Wow. If we connect this to the bigger picture, that's the whole story in miniature. The trial happens in 1826. J.S. Sr. pushes his son to transition his seer power from seeking money to a higher religious purpose, which would shield his activities from legal challenge.
The timing is critical. I mean, it's immediate. The very next year, September 1827, Joseph Smith retrieves the golden plates, not for financial gain, at least not initially, but for a spiritual mandate.
It suggests the plates narrative wasn't some parallel divine project ongoing since 1823.
It suggests it was a repurposed religious agenda adopted immediately after the legal and social trouble, all to maintain Joseph's status as a seer, but now under the legally protected umbrella of religious freedom. He repurposed his vocation to save his reputation.
It is clear that the Smith family's actions are just consistently rooted in this magical tradition. And nothing screams that louder than the date of the retrieval attempts, the fall equinox, September 22nd.
It's statistically improbable, isn't it, that a divine instruction would repeatedly select an occult magical date just by coincidence?
The sources confirm this, right? That this date was important in folk magic.
Yes, the sources confirm that this date used for the 1823, 1824, and 1827 attempts was known and used in European and American folk magic as a time when spirits were most active, when the veil between worlds was thin. It was seen as the best chance of successfully obtaining guarded or enchanted treasure.
Which begs the question, why would an angel of God or a divine command demand adherence to an occult magical calendar?
Well, because if the treasure was enchanted, as Joseph and Cowdery believed in 1823, then the treasure guardian Roni, the spirit, was bound by the rules of enchantment.
So the plates were still viewed as enchanted treasure, subject to the rules of folklore.
It strongly suggests that. It required the most potent magical date for retrieval, rather than just the simple decree of an omnipotent sovereign deity.
And this leads us to the absolute nightmare of the right person requirement, the tragic saga of Alvin Smith in 1824.
Joseph Knight Sr., who was a faithful patron of Joseph Smith and documented these events, he recounts that after the 1823 failure, Joseph was told to bring the right person the following year.
Joseph asks who, and the angel says,
"Your oldest brother, Alvin Smith."
This is just heartbreaking, and if you're looking at it through the lens of an omniscient God, it's highly problematic.
Terribly so. Alvin dies just 2 months later, in November 1824, right after that failed retrieval attempt in September. If God commanded Joseph to bring Alvin, only for Alvin to die, the divine instruction becomes not only impossible to follow, but needlessly cruel. Why set Joseph up for that kind of failure and grief?
It seems completely illogical, but if you view the guardian as a trickster figure...
Exactly. A common feature in folk magic meant to test, trick, or ultimately ensure the seeker fails to claim the treasure.
Then the instruction makes perfect sense. The trickster gives a requirement that is either impossible from the start or quickly becomes impossible, and that maintains the enchantment over the treasure.
And the fallout from this impossible command... It just demonstrates the extreme depth of the Smith family's belief in this folk magic worldview, even when faced with tragedy.
You're talking about the notice in the newspaper.
Yes. 5 days after Joseph's failed 1824 attempt, where he obviously didn't have Alvin, Joseph Smith Sr. posts a mortifying notice in the local paper.
Can you just walk us through the shock of that? I mean, this wasn't a private family matter. This was a public display of desperation.
It was devastating. J.S. Sr. claimed that due to malicious rumors that Alvin's body had been dug up and dissected, he and several neighbors had to exhume Alvin's grave to prove to the community that the body was still there. Imagine the pressure, the grief, and the public humiliation of having to disturb your recently deceased son's grave.
That is just so heavy. But from an analytical angle, why did that rumor even start?
This is where historian Dan Vogel's speculation becomes very compelling. He suggests that J.S. Sr. was the most likely source of the rumor.
Wait, his own father started the rumor. Why?
Because he had the singular magical incentive to dig up the body. If the angel required Alvin and Alvin was dead, the magical requirement might still be fulfilled by bringing Alvin's remains, or maybe his clothing or piece of the body, to the hill for the next equinox.
So you're suggesting Joseph Sr. may have spread the rumor himself as a cover story to justify his own action of trying to exhume the body to satisfy this magical requirement.
It fits the evidence perfectly. Why would Joseph Sr. be talking about his son's higher purpose on one hand and then engaging in the literal gruesome exhumation of his eldest son based on the instruction of a treasure guardian?
It shows an immense, unwavering conviction that the magical worldview was real.
And that the instructions, no matter how illogical or gruesome, had to be followed to obtain the enchanted plates. For them, the magical system was non-negotiable.
Okay, so after the Alvin complication makes the next couple of attempts impossible, Joseph Smith goes back to his trusted method, the peepstone.
Right. He uses his seer stone to determine the new right person to the 1827 retrieval, his future wife, Emma Hale.
The narrative needed a clean reset. But he quickly runs into another problem of control, this time with a fellow seer, Samuel Lawrence.
Yes. Lawrence was a local treasure digger and seer who had worked with Joseph before. Joseph sought out Lawrence's corroboration for the 1827 retrieval, but in doing so, He allowed Lawrence to insert new material into the narrative.
He loses narrative ground. Can you detail that incident?
Lawrence accompanies Joseph to the hill on the final night, and Lawrence asks Joseph to look in his peepstone to see if there was anything with the plates. Joseph looks and says, no, there's nothing else.
But Lawrence pushes him.
He does. He senses weakness. Or maybe he's trying to assert his own seer status. He presses him a second time, then a third time. There's that power of three again, to look specifically for a large pair of specs.
And what does Joseph do?
Joseph finally, and you get the sense it's reluctantly, he agrees to having seen the pair of spectacles. And this is critical. These spectacles, later retrofitted into the Urim and Thummim, the divine translation device, were a late addition to the story.
So they were essentially forced upon Joseph by a rival treasure digger.
A rival whose magical sight was apparently better than Joseph's in that moment.
Okay, let's pause on that implication. Couldn't a faithful apologist just claim that God inspired Lawrence to ask about the specs to make sure the divine tool was introduced at the right time?
They could, but that argument clashes directly with that crucial element of Joseph's control. If the spectacles were the divinely prepared translation tool, why did Joseph not see them initially? He had to be prompted repeatedly by a rival.
It really does scream of ad hoc storytelling. He had to agree to the specs to maintain his social status.
Exactly. If he had said, I still don't see them, Lawrence would have looked like the superior seer, which would completely undermine Joseph's authority just as he was launching this new sacred project.
So the sacred instrument was inserted into the historical record by the pressure of a competitor, not by the decree of an angel. That's a huge narrative problem.
And the trouble doesn't stop there.
Yeah.
We have an anachronism problem with the spectacles themselves. The sources note that the plates and spectacles were supposedly buried by Moroni around the 5th century CE. But the sources also confirm that the first actual wearable spectacles, two glass lenses joined by a frame, weren't invented until the 13th century CE in Italy.
That's an 800-year gap. The supposed divine translation device predates the existence of the technology it mimics by 8 centuries.
On top of that, if the spectacles were such a sacred, essential translation tool, why did Joseph Smith ultimately abandon them entirely for translation? Within months, he went back to using his old, familiar brown peepstone, the same one he used for treasure digging, to produce the entire Book of Mormon text.
I see the pattern. It suggests the spectacles were an invention that served a momentary need, placating Lawrence, providing a temporary sense of legitimacy, but were quickly discarded because they just complicated the central, more familiar method of translation.
Which was the seer stone in the hat.
Okay, so the 1827 retrieval. This is the climax of this whole folk magic narrative, and the sources detail it with such ritualistic specificity. Joseph eloped with Emma, borrowed Joseph Knight's black horse and carriage, got black clothes.
There was even a receipt for lamp black paint. It's all there. And again, we have to stress the continuity. If the 1826 trial was his religious pivot, and this was now a divine event, why is God demanding the specific use of black clothes, occult timing, and known treasure digging techniques?
And the timing, 2 a.m.
2 a.m. was known as the powerful hour over which Jupiter, the most favorable planet for obtaining treasure, presided. There is no separation here. It's a continuity of folk magic practice, just applied to a new type of treasure.
And let's talk about Emma, the new right person. She was required to retrieve the plates, yet the sources confirm she was forced to stay back with the carriage with her back turned to the digging.
This gives us a profound window into Joseph's intent and the nature of the event. Think about it. If Emma was a co-conspirator in a deliberate fraud, she would have been an invaluable, credible witness. She could say, yes, I saw him pull the heavy metallic plates out of the ground.
But she couldn't.
The fact that she was the required magical ingredient but was prevented from seeing anything strongly suggests she was not a co-conspirator. She believed the story, but Joseph needed her presence solely to fulfill the folk magic requirement, without her being able to visually inspect the lack of plates being pulled from the ground. He needed her belief, not her testimony.
This emphasizes that control element again. The moment the plates are allegedly retrieved, Joseph doesn't bring the sacred artifact home immediately.
No, he hides them in a hollow log until he can get a locked box.
Let's just dedicate some time to the absurdity of the hollow log. If you believe these are 40 to 60 pound golden artifacts, the most sacred documents on Earth, leaving them unguarded in a hollow log, a stereotypical folk magic hiding spot.
Especially with other treasure seekers, like Samuel Lawrence actively searching the hill. It just defies all logic, duty, and common sense.
So why hide them in a log?
This strongly supports the theory that Joseph hadn't finished fabricating the required prop plates in time for the equinox deadline. He needed to show he retrieved them at the ritualistic time, but he couldn't bring the finished product home yet.
The hollow log buys him time.
A few days, maybe a few weeks. Time to secure the plates and the lockbox, allowing him to present the finished artifact when he had narrative control and a safe place to put it.
Then we get the incredible cinematic story of the journey home. Joseph, despite having a bad leg, runs home at top speed with the 40 to 60 pound plates in one hand.
And is attacked by three separate assailants with guns, who he knocks down, and he eventually dislocates his own thumb fighting the third attacker.
This is where the narrative leaps fully from historical account into folklore. It's right up there with Paul Bunyan or John Henry.
Let's make this visceral for the listener. The 40 to 60 pound estimate, that comes from several contemporary accounts about how heavy the plates felt to those who were allowed to touch them through a cloth. That is the weight of a heavy cement bag or a fully grown 3-year-old child.
So imagine running at top speed for miles over uneven terrain while carrying a 3-year-old child in one arm and simultaneously fending off three armed men.
The sheer physical impossibility is astronomical. Running, jumping, fighting with a 40 to 60 pound object held in one hand, an object that would constantly shift his center of gravity, it's simply beyond human capability, especially for someone who, by his own account, had a noticeable limp.
And the assailants are conveniently spaced out.
Exactly. If three rivals knew he had the treasure, they would have ambushed him together at the hiding spot or waited for him together at the end of the road. Why would they space themselves out perfectly for Joseph to defeat them one by one, like video game bosses?
It reads like a heavily embroidered retrospective tale. It's designed to explain the physical injury he sustained and to add dramatic flair to the story.
And Dan Vogel offered a far more plausible, non-supernatural explanation for that dislocated thumb.
The fabrication process.
Right. The thumb injury was more likely sustained while trying to bend stiff metal D-rings or binding prop plates together, a process that would require immense concentrated pressure on the thumb and wrist. This accidental injury then provides a perfect, dramatic, and heroic backstory for the missing witness and the breathless arrival home.
So, if the supernatural accounts are full of folk magic and the physical accounts are full of impossibility, then the physical reality of the plates themselves presents even greater problems.
We face massive historical hurdles. First, there's no credible evidence of lengthy records on metal plates in the Americas. Second, no evidence of ancient Native Americans possessing the sophisticated metallurgy required for working with gold or copper alloys on that scale.
And we're talking about binding, engraving, creating a substantial metallic object.
And third, no evidence exists of written language or knowledge of Hebrew or Egyptian, the two alleged languages, in North America at that time.
And he chose the language Reformed Egyptian, specifically because it was untranslatable by anyone in 1830, which maintains his complete control. This brings us to the critical linguistic math problem.
Yes. Fair Mormon, in their apologetics, often cites the Pyrgi tablets from Italy, dated around 500 BCE, as their best evidence for ancient records on metal plates. They suggest this shows Joseph Smith wasn't just guessing.
So we have an actual surviving artifact to compare against the claim. Let's look at the data on these Pyrgi tablets.
The data actually dismantles the plates narrative. These three tablets are small, roughly 7.5 by 3.5 inches. They're important, two in Etruscan and one in Phoenician. But crucially, all three plates combined total only 200 words.
200 words, that's a short inscription, like a dedication or a prayer.
It shows metal was used for short, monumental records, but not for history books.
Okay, now for the terrifying math that really crushes the feasibility argument.
If we compare those 200 words across three plates, that's roughly 67 words per plate. The Book of Mormon has a conservative word count of 174,610 words, allegedly translated from only 14 plates, and that's just the unsealed portion.
So the math requires that each Book of Mormon plate hold over.
Over 19,000 words. The efficiency needed for that is just astounding. To put this in perspective, if we use the Pyrgi tablet word density as the historical standard, Joseph Smith would have needed approximately 6,750 gold plates to fit the Book of Mormon word count.
6,750 gold plates.
And that includes the two-thirds sealed portion, which would be even more massive.
That would create a stack so massive it'd be like a small, heavy anvil. No one would be running at top speed with that, let alone fighting off three assailants. The math kills the physical feasibility by showing precisely why people in the ancient world never wrote long records on metal.
It's too inefficient, too heavy, and requires resources they just didn't have.
And that's the final impossibility. If we grant that Reformed Egyptian was so condensed that it could achieve this, that entire chapters could fit on a single character.
Then you run into a contradiction in the text itself. Later in the Book of Mormon, the writers, like Moroni, complain about the inefficiency of their language, wishing they had more room to write.
The two ideas are mutually exclusive. For the text to fit, the language must be maximally efficient, but the writers claim their language is not efficient enough.
The only way to make the story physically or linguistically plausible is to rely entirely on what's called special pleading, a refusal to apply normal standards of evidence, probability, or logic, because divine intervention is claimed.
You have to accept that the very laws of physics and linguistic density were somehow suspended for this one object,
despite all the evidence of ancient record-keeping pointing to the exact opposite conclusion.
So this deep dive, it reveals a fundamental, unbreakable consistency throughout the whole narrative. The gold plate story is not a departure from Joseph Smith's treasure-digging worldview.
No, it's a direct continuation. It uses the exact same folk magic techniques, the equinox, the right person, the peepstone, the power of three, even when those elements became historically or logically problematic, like Alvin's death or the need to explain a dislocated thumb.
The recurring pattern is one of narrative and physical control. Joseph's success was entirely dependent on maintaining control over who saw the objects, because they likely couldn't pass visual inspection.
Right. Emma must turn her back, the plates have to be hidden in a log, the alleged attack has no witnesses, and the physical and linguistic evidence, the weight, the anachronism of the spectacles, the Purgi tablets' math, it all demonstrates extreme material improbability.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner? The story of the golden plates only works if you grant special pleading. That is the logical fallacy of applying a rigorous standard to everyone else's claims, but making an exception for your own case.
And if you accept that standard, that historical inconsistencies, physical improbabilities, and documented magical origins can just be dismissed because with God all things are possible, how can you logically distinguish this foundational story from any other movement built entirely on unprovable, conflicting, and physically impossible claims?
We'd encourage you to research the contemporary 1820s accounts for yourself and evaluate the evidence that was written in real time. Ask yourself, what implications does the consistent, unavoidable use of folk magic and treasure-digging methodology have for the divine origin and nature of the Book of Mormon?
The evidence suggests that Joseph Smith was a successful seer whose skills evolved from finding filthy lucre to finding sacred treasure. But the methodology, that never changed.
Thank you for joining us for the deep dive. We hope this analysis provided the comprehensive context you needed to make an informed evaluation. We'll catch you next time.